Exploring the events shaping our lives through original documentary storytelling.
We'll hear arguments pro against Wade.
The documentary from the BBC World Service is a window onto the wider world.
The security situation in Europe has changed in the last couple of years dramatically.
Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to On the Podium on the BBC World Service. I'm Eliza Skinner, and this is the show where each week our guests reveal how they became Olympic or Paralympic champions and the challenges they overcame. And I listen out for the bits that sound impossible to believe, like how can you win gold in the marathon and not suffer the world's worst chafing? Anyway, the BBC's athletics commentator, Ed Harry, and Paralympian Scout Bassett are with me as always to rub shoulders with some of the greats. All of us do a lot of traveling in our careers. Do you guys have any particular travel pet peeves?
Yes, I will start. One of my main pet peeves is on airplanes, when people take off not just their shoes, but also their socks on the plane.
Fully nude feet? No, no way.
I mean, I kind of understand the taking off the shoe part because, you know, your feet swell and when you fly, and I get that part. But keep the socks on. This is not your house. It's not your car. It's not your personal space. This is a public space. There's other people going to be sitting in that seat. And I just think it's gross. I've actually seen people that have walked down the aisle to the bathroom.
Oh, no. That was what I was going to say. Because it's to me, it's wild enough if you're going to take your shoes and socks off. But there is a way for people to do that. And I, another passenger, might never know about it. But sometimes they'll do it and, like you said, walk down the aisle or put their feet up. Yeah. I have had, you know, the back of your armrest, like a little foot, little tootsies poking up from the seat behind you. Absolutely. It's an act of violence. It's aggression I should not have to suffer.
I agree. That's disgusting.
I was once on a London bus and I was hearing a noise and I didn't know what the noise was. Somebody was cutting their nails.
No.
Oh, no.
And just letting it fall onto the floor.
No.
Yeah.
I remember making peace with, when I lived in New York, realizing, watching somebody do that on the subway, cut their fingernails, and thinking, oh, okay, so this city is a huge apartment that I share with all of these people. And sometimes we're in the living room together, and sometimes we're in the bathroom together, and sometimes we're in the kitchen together, and you just have to expect that people are going to do their weird stuff. But that is so upsetting. I think that maybe we should make socks that say, don't worry, these won't come off, for people to wear on planes. So like when they take their shoe off and it reveals the sock, anyone who's like, oh gosh, no, please don't take the sock off, they'll be reassured. This foot will not be nude.
They could say cleared for flight or something as well. You could even market those. People always probably do.
Yes,
already.
Yes.
Special socks for planes.
TSA approved.
Yeah.
Socks. Yeah, I also, as far as on the actual flight pet peeves, if you're in a middle seat, those armrests are yours. And if you're in an aisle or a window, you got to give up the armrest. Give it to that middle seat person. I have had so many people like try to take over the whole armrest. And I'm like, when I'm in the middle seat, and I'm like, that's all I got. That's all I have. You can lean against a wall. You can lean into the aisle. But me, all I have are these little spikes.
Wait, I have a question about planes. Are there any rules about what foods you can bring on planes? I saw somebody bring on, you know, those like crab boil.
Oh, like the wet sack, like a wet plastic bag full of crawfish or crab bits.
You know, it has all these spices and you have to peel the thing, bring a whole bag of that on a plane and put the tray down and create the sprawl. And of course, that's something that's a very finger food thing, right? You don't do that with utensils. And the mess and the smell and the looks that this passenger got, I mean, they deserved it, frankly.
Because they didn't share it. Because you need to bring little tiny baggies with one crab leg for everybody else there. So
there's just some foods you just don't bring on a plane, and that was one of them. Don't bring your crawfish boil, crab boil, like, onto a plane.
No.
Right, let's get on the podium. Who's with us this week, Ed?
Our guest today won water polo gold at the Rio Olympics and then again 5 years later at the delayed Tokyo Games. In between, while celebrating a world championship win with teammates, the balcony she was standing on collapsed. NBA legend, the late Kobe Bryant, was a big mentor as she began her recovery. Her return to the top of the Olympic podium came in the same city, Tokyo, where her father had swum for Canada at the Games of 1964. And she's a pro surfer as well. Kaylee Gilchrist, welcome to On the Podium.
Thanks, guys. I'm excited to be here and chat a little bit about my journey.
Yeah, we're so excited to have you here. To guide that chat about your journey, we have a few photos from your life, and let's take a look at the first one.
I know, I'm nervous what photos they're going to be.
Your most embarrassing moments. No, just kidding. Yeah.
This is the moment that you and your Team USA teammates in water polo became Olympic champions in Rio in 2016. You are, I think, fourth from the right, as we look at this picture. You're all lined up. What are the emotions on the podium? Because the first thing to say is there's a lot of you standing there and it's a team sport. What was it like sharing that moment with your teammates?
It's so surreal. It's kind of hard to describe because it's just overwhelming. You know, you as an individual, I've been dreaming of that moment since, you know, as you started playing water polo, but more importantly, us as a team started out in 2013 together, and lots of sacrifices, lots of hard work, tears, a lot of things that the outside world doesn't know. And I think that obviously brought us together as a team and made this dream come true. And I think that's the coolest thing, is being on the podium with, we always call each other, you know, sisters, and those that have been a part of the journey and the ups and downs. So it was obviously an overwhelming moment, but one that I'm forever grateful for, and obviously forever grateful for every woman in that photo.
I'm the idiot of the group. I am the least related to sports. I'm a comedian. How many people are on the team and how many people are in the game at one time? Because that's a lot of people in that photo.
Right. So it's kind of crazy. Training camp usually starts in May of the year after the Olympics. And we'll probably start with an initial of 25 females. And they'll come and go throughout the quad. Younger women will come up and get invited. We all come together in Long Beach, California, and we'll train and for the entire year together. And there's usually about 18 women in that training squad for the full-time year. You're asked to leave high school, leave college, move down to Southern California so we can all be together. And out of those 18 women, only 13 make an Olympic team. And that's usually announced only a month before we depart for the Olympics. So it's kind of crazy. You're training 18 of you in hopes of making your dreams come true. And you walk into your coach's meeting room and you either figure out if your dream comes true or you're absolutely heartbroken. So it's really, really tough. And then those 13 people will move forward and go to the Olympic Games. And at one time, there's 6 field players and 1 goalie. So 7 people are in the pool at one time.
Wow.
Really high stakes.
It's so many moments of possible loss or win along the way.
Totally. And it's, you know, you're obviously competing to be the best and to beat the best teams in the world, but the entire journey, you're competing with your teammates who are also your best friends. So it gets really complicated and it's really tough, but we'll talk about it a lot as a team because we understand we just want whatever's best for this team to reach their ultimate goals. And sometimes that may not be the best player. It may be a player that is better out of the water and is a good teammate rather than someone who's in the pool, has a better shot or is faster. So it's really like a puzzle piece. And we're just trying to figure out what those pieces are to kind of make the puzzle whole.
Why water polo?
I grew up in Newport Beach, Southern California. So water polo here is, it's obviously a smaller sport around the world, but here it's just like a football. It's just like a soccer. And I was a tomboy growing up. So I played every sport from skateboarding, snowboarding, flag football. But I also started swimming at a young age, following in my father's footsteps, who was a 2-time Olympian for Canada. And I realized, I was like, I don't understand how you did this for as long as you did. Like, swimming is so boring. Sorry for those if you guys are swimmers. But I was like, this, like, staring at this black line, like, I need something more. That was the time when one of my best friends, Christopher Crabe, His mom's like, you know, we've been taking Christopher to water polo practice. Like, I think Kaylee would enjoy it. So at the age of 8, I was playing on the 10 and under co-ed team and basically have been playing since.
You also played basketball growing up?
Right. I love basketball. Like, basketball is my first dream. And we actually recently were like cleaning out all my school projects. And there was, I don't know, whatever project, what it was. But I was like, I dream of going to the WNBA and playing for the LA Sparks, just like Lisa Leslie.
Played it all the way to the 8th grade. And I just think I had a realization of that I could go further in water polo. But I was a diehard basketball fan, watched every Lakers game, have all my basketball cards still somewhere in the garage. And the sport actually helped me a lot in water polo. I think all sports did, but especially basketball. And it was very similar setup as water polo. So in basketball, I just learned to have good vision and could see the court well. And that definitely is a direct correlation with how I play the game. You know, I play on the right-hander side of water polo, and I have good vision and good passing. So I think a lot of that actually is due to so many years of playing basketball.
Obviously, the games or the matches are a certain length of time, but you're treading in water for forever. And for practice, you know, how long is that compared to an actual match?
Right. So for our matches, it's 4 quarters of 8 minutes. So they're actually pretty quick games, which is great for being user-friendly. You know, it's not like baseball where you're there for hours on hours. So that is good. It goes by quick. But for practice, you know, we're practicing 6 hours a day, you know, 6 days a week. So obviously all that those hours aren't exactly in the pool. You know, we'll do weights, we'll do mindfulness, we'll do outside of the water scouting, but we're in the pool, you know, 3 to 4 hours a day, and it's nonstop. So yeah, it's a lot of work. You know, I always try to compare water polo or tell people it's kind of the physicality of hockey with the speed and cadence of like basketball and soccer.
And how deep is the pool?
It kind of differs, but basically it's too deep to stand. So at least 8 feet or deeper in all of our pools. So yeah, there is no treading. I mean, sorry, there's no standing, only treading. And you only can use one hand unless you're a goalie to touch the ball. So yeah, it's definitely difficult.
And that's deep enough for the horses. Just kidding. but are the rules at all similar with polo and water polo? Is it weird that you have like some slight association with this incredibly different sport?
I know, it's like literally you couldn't pick the exact opposite sport, but we'll always mess around every once in a while because we often get, you know, if you're traveling in the airports and you say like USA water polo, they don't understand, especially if we're in foreign countries because the sport is a little smaller. They'll ask us questions, and sometimes depending on what mood my teammates and I are, we'll just maybe sometimes say, yeah, so we all own our own horses, they travel and they're getting in the cargo ship, we'll meet them over there. Pull their leg a little bit.
I guess we sometimes ask our guests about when they became aware of the Olympics, but obviously your father had swum at the Olympic Games. So was the Olympics itself always something that you had a keen awareness of? And were you ever thinking that one day, maybe if you didn't know the sport yet, that you'd like to go all the way there?
The first time, like I would use it as bragging rights at school, like, oh, well, my dad was an Olympian, but not even understanding what that meant. But I remember vividly the 2000 Sydney Games. So I was 8 years old, and just how excited my dad was to watch, specifically the swimming. So I think that was the first memory that I had of like, okay, the Olympics are awesome. Like, this is cool, and could see his excitement for it. And shortly after, I think he saw that I enjoyed it. So he went out and found some 1964 Tokyo cassettes, and we watched him in hopes to find his race. We never found his race, I don't think, but my journey was a little different. Through high school, you know, surfing was pulling me. So I kind of not gave up on my Olympic journey, but I just had bigger dreams to achieve surfing. And, you know, my little self dreamt of going to the Olympics, took a break, wanted to be surfer Kaylee, and then kind of came back to water polo Kaylee.
I think we have another photo.
We've got a picture of US team again, this time in South Korea. World freaking champions is what you say alongside this one. I'm reading out some of your words. This was a world championship win. I should say that right at the beginning of the program, we said that you won Olympic gold in Rio, and you won it 5 years later in Tokyo. Tokyo was delayed because of the pandemic. If it had gone ahead in 2020, you would probably have missed the games because of what happened to you in 2019, and that was this year at this World Championships. Just explain to us what happened when you were out celebrating what should have been a wonderful night of all your life, celebrating a World Championship win.
Yeah, I mean, it was crazy. So we played Spain, who was a longtime rival in this game, and we came out like guns blazing, just crushed them. Everyone was ecstatic. Everyone on the team played really well. I was personally having a pretty decent tournament too. And after the tournament, you know, we always go out and celebrate because you usually fly home the next day. And so we're celebrating, and it was later in the night and the balcony collapsed. Like, we were in this nightclub that I was up top with all the water polo people, and it collapsed and you didn't really understand what was going on. And I got pinned down by some teammates and we had to get rushed out. Ambulance came. I was bleeding, had a really deep leg laceration, and was sent to the hospital where I underwent surgery shortly after and had to stay, I think, 4 or 5 days in South Korean hospital while everyone else flew home the next day. Obviously, like, very traumatic experience. There was 2 local South Koreans who passed away during it. And just to go under surgery in a foreign country is a lot. And then I was worried because at that time the Olympics were scheduled for maybe, I think it was like 10 months later. And I was just thinking like, oh no, like, worried about making the team, or let alone like, I woke up from surgery and just realized how lucky I was. I was millimeters away from my nerve on my left leg, which is basically like millimeters away from having a functioning foot again. So I think it took a while to process with everything. And I mean, obviously with how scary the situation was of COVID, but it ended up being kind of a blessing in disguise for me to just focus a lot on, you know, my mental and physical health to get where I wanted to be.
How accurate was your view of your injury? Were you concerned? Did you think it wasn't that bad, or did you think it was much worse than it was? Or
no, I never looked down at my leg. And I think that was great because I woke up from surgery and saw the photos that were taken on my phone and saw the surgery photo. And I was like, if I saw that, I would have passed out immediately. So it was really big, like kind of looked like a shark bite. So I think that helped me kind of stay present. And then I do remember like holding my teammate's hand, telling her I wasn't really feeling well, and just like for her not to leave me. And that was kind of when I was like going in and out of consciousness from the loss of blood. But I think as soon as the ambulance came, like, I felt maybe just like at ease a little bit, knowing that there was help, which I don't know if that was the truth or not. And I was able to kind of get together, get my stuff together, and FaceTime my family when I was in the ambulance. So there was like one moment when I was on the sidewalk where I didn't really know like how bad it was or wasn't.
What did you say to your family? What did you say to them in the ambulance when they FaceTimed you?
I said, what did I say? Something along the lines like, there's been an accident. Like, I'm okay, but I'm on my way to the hospital. I have a bad cut in my leg or something like that. And there was probably a little bit more curse words involved. And then I just remember telling him like, no, somebody passed away. And at that point, I don't think we knew if it was an athlete or not. Obviously like the worst phone call to receive, and they didn't have many answers. And it was kind of all hectic because everyone had different memories of the night and everyone was involved to one way or the other. So it was crazy. The men's trainer was still out and he came running, and he was the one that actually was in the ambulance with me. And he immediately took off his belt and tourniquet my leg, and at least was forward thinking in that sense. And definitely, again, like, he just, what are the odds that he was still out down the street and someone went in to grab him and he came over and had those thoughts to act upon. So there's a lot of like little moments like that where kind of all worked out, as scary as it was, but able, like, in my favor.
You touched a little bit about where you were leading up to Tokyo. And I know so much of it was tied to the injury and this traumatic event. Can you, if you're comfortable, talk about more perhaps the mental impact or just the journey that you were on to work through that trauma, to get yourself in a place where you could make the games?
Whether I knew it or not, I was like pushing away all the mental and just physically worrying about it. Like, our trainer Larnie and I called it the Mamba mission. So I like land August 1st of 2019 and I get this Google Doc and it's just like all of our schedules, all of our goals, like, so organized. And I think I use that in the Mamba mission and rehabbing with her to distract me from actually what was going on. So I'd be at the pool at 6 a.m. and I wouldn't be home until 7 p.m. like every single day. And it, like, the work we did was awesome and we had fun definitely doing it. But I think there should have been time to work about the mental stuff and the PTSD that I dealt with. But I also think there's an important thing to let people have the time to be able to work through that. Like, oftentimes coaches or even families like, do you want to go speak to someone? I was like, no, like, I will. You know, it wasn't until I was ready to finally be able to kind of tackle that. But, you know, there were signs like getting in the elevator. There was this instance in South Korea going into the elevator. And then when I came home, getting in an elevator, obviously I'm on crutches or in a wheelchair. And I hated the feeling. Like, I would take up 6 stairs crutching on 1 foot. I was like, okay, that's probably not a good sign. Like, it was basically like a claustrophobic panic feeling. And I was like, ah, I'll worry about it later. Like, I have to focus on getting back. And then I think, you know, Kobe Bryant was a huge mentor. I met him and we followed each other on social before. But on my way home from South Korea from the hospital, I decided to message him. And he messaged me right back being like, yo, I swear I just saw your name on the news. I was just about to message you. Like, I literally picked up my phone to message you. And I used him, which obviously as like, a little girl who was obsessed with the Lakers and with basketball and idolizing him my entire career, I was as giddy as can be and continued to use him as a resource. And, you know, he would message me back. He would check in on me. He gave me some of his contacts. You know, I had hopes and dreams of one day, like inviting him to a water polo game or like meeting him for coffee and thanking him in person. And then I think when he passed, like that brought up so much trauma. Obviously, like that was just the most tragic thing ever. But I think personally, it brought up a lot of trauma from South Korea because he was kind of intertwined with all of it. And shortly after, maybe a month after, is when I first had my first panic attack when we were training Colorado Springs. And that was the moment I was like, okay, this, like, I'm finally ready to go get help. So we immediately went from that panic attack where basically I fainted in my coach's arms one day and went to our sports psych and talked about everything with him. And 2 days later, when we flew home, I went to therapy and was working through a lot of different types of therapy for months after.
Wow. I mean, not to be too cheesy, but it sounds like he was sort of an emotional tourniquet for you. And then when he was gone, all this stuff came rushing at you.
Totally. And then shortly after, I think my first therapy session in person was a week before everything shut down. So I always think like kind of crazy that, you know, we stopped water polo, but we could still do these Zooms meetings for different types of therapy. I was doing like 3 different types, 3 times a week, which is also very draining, but I was able to fully commit to that and immerse myself, which I think if I was training 6 days a week, I'd probably show up because I knew it was the right thing to do, but I don't know if I could have been as present as I was.
And the job that I do as a broadcaster, we obviously covered the death of Kobe Bryant and his daughter Gianna and 7 others in that helicopter crash. And it was one of those moments that you think, well, I'm the one at work today and we need to do a very good job here because this is so important to so many people. And the Grammys were right about then as well. And there was a lot of public mourning and outpouring, but to have made a friendship with him and for his words and his support to be helping you. And then 4 months into when you really needed him and other people in your life to lose him at that point. I mean, I can only imagine what that would have been like, because I mean, first of all, going all the way back to being a little girl, being a fan of basketball, when you realized Kobe Bryant was a fan of yours, what was that like?
It was crazy. You know, I met him in person twice before. And the first time I met him, it was at the Babo Bay Club where I swim and work out. And he was coaching Gianna's team up in the gym. And I knew he was there. So I was like, went for my swim. I knew practice ended at like 11 or something. So I was like, okay, I got 45 minutes to get my swim, but really I have 45 minutes to figure out what the heck I'm going to say to Kobe. So I like planned it out in my head and you walk down the stairs and I went up like, hi, Mr. Bryant. My name's Kaylee Gilchrist. I wore number 10, the same number as you representing Team USA. And he's like, you play water polo? He's like, yeah, we watched you guys. Like, Gianna, remember watching the girls win gold? Like, that's epic. And he was just, you know, the only person to make me starstruck. And then again, I was on the Team USA committee for surfing and we were up at Mamba Academy and met him there. And I like went up, I was like, I don't know if he's going to remember. I would go to shake his hand and he like grabs me, like gives me a big bear hug. He's like, oh, come on, give me a hug, Kaylee, which was like so cool. I mean, there's just a bunch of different little stories like that. Like my buddy, Michael Spezia, saw him at the gym because he's from Newport and they're like shooting hoops. And he goes, oh, I went to Rio to watch Kaylee. And he goes, ah, huge fan of hers. And just kind of stuff that if you told me like my 8-year-old self, like, I'm like, there's no way Kobe would even know who I was. Just realize like how cool and grateful I am to have had those memories shared with him.
You're listening to On the Podium with me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. With us is Kaylee Gilchrist, American double gold medal water polo star.
It sounds like your recovery was sort of separated into training recovery and then really concentrated psychological sort of recovery because of COVID partly. How did you end up putting all of that together? Was that easy or was there a transition?
By, I would even say February 1st, like there was barely anything wrong physically with me, but I wasn't playing the way I wanted to. I, you know, wasn't the same me as I wanted to be. So in a weird way, like you said, definitely it was two different types of recovery. And all my mentors, like Kobe was obsessed with working out, like getting up at 5 a.m. So that's what I'm going to have to do. And I think I realized like that works to some degrees or like works a little bit depending on what part you are in your journey. And I was always that athlete. And I think COVID let me go. I mean, I'm still crazy for sure, but not nearly as much as I once was. And I think COVID let me kind of forget about water polo. And I was just spending a lot of time with, you know, family and close friends and being able to go, you know, surf, kind of reconnect with surfing, which I hadn't been able to do for a while. And I think obviously there was a lot of work that was done mentally and that was exhausting in its own regards. But I think it just let me realize like, all right, there's so many bigger things than water polo. And when I came back fresher, basically.
So like a more of a whole human than just a water polo excellence machine.
Yeah, exactly.
Was it a little bit intimidating? You've described to us the kind of the way it works, you know, for pretty much the whole of the Olympic cycle. So a 4-year program, there's a big squad of you, people come in, people get out or drop out of that, more people come in, and then it gets cut and cut and cut until you get the squad that you take to the games. Were you like hungering to get back into that system, or were you a little bit worried or concerned that should you be shown a bit more leeway and should you be treated differently, or was part of you thinking, no, I should be treated exactly the same? There's been a little bit of a conflict there, but you had come back from something very, very traumatic. So did you kind of get or expect any special treatment?
No, I mean, it was really interesting. Like there was no one on our team has ever been through a situation like that. So there is, I mean, in regards to both South Korea and COVID. So there is no like playbook of how to go through something. So there are some things that I think our coach and our staff and our players did amazing. And then there's some things where it's like, well, maybe looking back on it now, I would have done something different, or maybe I would have spoken up about something a little bit more. You know, it's easy to say, okay, we won gold, so everything we did was right. But at the same time, like maybe some of the things we did took away from our fun and our joy from the sport and maybe put a bitter taste in some players' mouth. So you never know. It's like, yeah, you see the success of this team, but there's a lot that goes through it. So, but I think for the most part, and especially in my situation, you know, I was never looking for, you know, poor me because I went through all of this. You know, I just wanted to be viewed as everyone else and like basically also viewed as somebody that people can look up to overcome adversity.
You mentioned that you got to spend some time during that era, surfing. It seems to me, I would assume that surfing, is really kind of isolating, like a very solo sport versus water polo. It's such a team sport. Is that correct? Or do I just know that from movies?
No, I mean, I think a little bit of the opposite in a weird way, because surfing has such a community and like growing up in that surfing community has been, you know, the most special thing and reason why I love it and why I always come back to it. And the way I explained the team, like the team can almost be isolating because for the water polo team, because you're competing against all these people and you're always trying to make a team or compare yourself, you know, whether you try not to, you always try to compare yourself to another person or the person in your position or a person getting more playing time. And when you're just free surfing with your friends out, you know, and the waves are good and you're at your home break and everyone out there knows and we're all hooting and hollering each other and into a wave, it's, you know, that's the best. My favorite memories of all time would be, you know, those surfing memories of cheering each other on. So I guess I'll put it this way so I don't get in trouble with the water polo team.
But yeah, we don't want that.
Yeah. I will forever be surfing until my body physically can't do it. I will be done with water polo, knock on wood, I make the Paris Olympics, but I will be done with water polo the last day of the Paris Games.
Okay.
But there's something to be said, obviously, about being a part of a team and having a bunch of individuals come together for, you know, a team goal. That's something I'm forever grateful for. And, you know, I don't know how fun water polo practice 6 hours a day is versus, you know, surfing good waves 6 hours a day. But, you know, there's definitely some pluses for both. And I love them both.
In your lifetime as a elite athlete, surfer and water polo player, initially, surfing wasn't an option at the Olympics. But by the time we got to Tokyo, it was. And of course, it is again in Paris. Ever tempted to go down the surfing route for the Paris Olympic Games? Or as you say, is it going to be water polo to try and get 3 golds in a row?
Yeah, I mean, I actually thought they announced it when we were in Rio in 2016 that surfing was finally going to be an Olympic sport. And the only surfing Olympics we had is this thing called the International Surfing Association World Games. And Fernando, who's the president, always said, like, I'm going to make this Olympic sport. We're going to do it. We're going to do it. I've been pushing. And it's kind of a trip because I went to 5 of those and we had an opening ceremonies. We all poured sand from our home countries into this awesome, like, giant glass thing. You could see all the different levels. And I vividly remember Fernando always saying that in my head. I'm like, yeah, right. Like, there's no way. And to come full circle and see again the Olympics and knowing Fernando and how awesome he is, it's just really cool to see that for the sport. And then I actually had thoughts in 2016 that I was going to be done. And that was my goal. And then it just happened too quick. Like, there was a lot of stress and I knew I basically had 1 year to make a decision whether during 2017, it was either I have to come back to the team now or else they're going to resent me and I might never make it, or I'm going to have to go all in with surfing. So that was a really tough time in my professional career of knowing what to do. And I struggled a lot with that, but obviously made the right decision for water polo in Tokyo. And it was really cool because the girls I grew up with surfing and the guys I grew up with surfing were in the Olympics. So I traveled the world with Chloe and Dino. He was at all 5 of the tournaments I was at in the ISA games for Team USA, and to see him in the village and cheer him on, and Caroline Marks and Carissa Moore, who are my friends, and even a lot of the others from different countries. So, you know, I kind of take a step back and obviously, you know, I'm so competitive and think about me and my journey, but it was really cool to see them get there. Now with Paris coming up, the decision is made. It's only like 20 athletes female and then 20 athletes for male. So there's not a lot of surfers. So it's really difficult to qualify for your country. Nearly impossible. Only 2 Americans will make it. And they're deciding after this season. So you'll know by September who's going to be an Olympian for the next year. So I like weighed my options and realized, like, percentage wise, like, could I get to that place? Like, who knows? Maybe. I would never say no, but it's going to be a lot harder to get to that place than it is to get there for water polo. So maybe 2028 when it's in LA.
So you're saying there's a chance?
There's a little chance.
Okay. It sounded like when you were talking about surfing before that it part of its value to you is, you know, the community, and also that it's not as competitive, that you're all celebrating each other. Do you worry at all that you would lose that if you were competing on that kind of stage with it? Or is it easy for you to have it be a friendly thing sometimes and a competitive thing sometimes? Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. I think there's a little bit of me that knows that I've never been able to go 100% at competitive surfing. And I think I have, you know, awareness and a perspective that, like, okay, if this is hindering my relationship with the sport that I love, then it might be time to retire competitively. Or if I'm enjoying it, then, like, continue. Maybe I'm losing every heat, maybe I'm making heats and can qualify for the next step up, because I see surfing burnout, competitive surfing burnout a lot of individuals who are a lot younger than me, but they've spent 7 years traveling around the world, and it sounds glamorous, but it's really not. You're scraping by, you're not making a lot of money, you're traveling around the world to surf a 1 foot crappy beach break, and you lose. You have a 20 minute heat and you lose, and then you got to pack up your bags and go to the next crappy 1 foot beach break around the world and spend too much money. So it can be exhausting, and I do see the burnout, which is, you know, thankful for water polo I haven't had, because I haven't had the time to commit to surfing.
I hear what you're saying. I shouldn't get into it. I get it. I mean, I thought I was a little old anyway, but this decides it for me. Yeah.
I think we have another photo. This is a wedding.
This is a fake wedding. I should preface that.
It's a fake wedding. I'm looking at, yeah.
What is this?
There's lots of different costumes going on here. What is going on here? Let's do it like that.
So I have to say, this was my sister's idea, and she got married in 2018. So I copied her, and it was basically a combined bachelor and bachelorette, but they went over the top and did a full blown ceremony. They had their best friend be an officiant. And then, so Tom and I are like, we have to do this. So we got a bunch of friends out there, and this is at a place called the Desert Bar. And we all ran to the Desert Bar. It's every President's Day weekend called the Desert Dash. It's a 5K to the bar where there's live music, fun. There's this like beautiful vintage church just waiting to have a picture in front of. So everyone here ran. Like, Sam, the guy on the right, was in his overalls running, and he was our officiant for the day. So it was just a lot of fun. It wasn't our real wedding, but yeah, we had a blast out there.
I'm just fascinated by the shoes. Everybody brought shoes to change into, right? They weren't running in these cowboy boots, were they?
No, she walked the 5K in the cowboy boots.
Wow.
Our friends committed.
Dedication.
I had to put a PSA on my Instagram because the amount of texts and comments I got saying congratulations, and I was like, you guys, this isn't our real wedding. Our real wedding date actually is after the Paris Olympics, and it just happens to be on 8/24/24, so Kobe Day.
Oh.
And will you be copying this kind of styling?
Our attire may look a little nicer, a little more chic.
Oh wow, we're now looking at the proposal. So this is Tom on his knee, next to a little tent or gazebo on the beach. Blue sky, little sort of wisps of white cloud. It looks like the perfect proposal. What did Tom manage to surprise you with all of this?
I'll tell him he did. There are some signs that stuck out that I'm like, you know what? I could dive deeper and ruin the surprise, or I could just let it be. So I was still pretty surprised, but we were actually in the Outer Banks of in North Carolina for a surf contest. And so Tom got the ring and he's like, I'm going to do it. Like, I think it was burning a hole in his pocket. So I would like to think Tom set up the gazebo or cabana, but that was all my sister. And but he did a great job.
And you mentioned that the wedding day and it's all inked in for after Paris 2024. You'll know the answer to this, and I think people want to know, has any team ever won 3 water polo gold medals in a row at the Olympic Games? And by the time you get to Paris, I know, of course, you'll hope to be in that team, but how many of you potentially could have been there all the way through Rio and Tokyo and Paris as well?
Well, actually, USA won in 2012. So we already have a couple 3-time gold medalists.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. We have 2 teammates, Maggie Steffens and Melissa Seideman, 1-3. Melissa retired after Tokyo. Maggie's still around. So she's going for 4, which has never happened. So I'll take 3 and she can take 4.
We saw you on the podium in Rio and in Tokyo. Given what happened leading up to Tokyo, did the feeling change? Was there did it mean more to you given the injury and the traumatic event the second time around, or did it feel the same?
Oh man, it was, I think, completely different feelings. I think there's something to be said about the first, and we also had our family and friends in the stands, and you know, we didn't have that in Tokyo. So obviously being on the podium was amazing, but one of my favorite experiences was hugging my family afterwards, running over to the stands and hugging all of them and seeing all my friends and curly haired wigs and beers in their hand. Like, there's just something, nothing quite like that. And then I think Tokyo was such a personal journey for me, things that I went through, obviously the injury, Kobe passed away, but also one of my biggest mentors, Coach Barnett, passed away too. He was my high school coach. Like, there was just a lot of crazy stuff. So I kind of thought like more of a personal journey and being able to kind of overcome all of that was very significant for me, and my family too has been a part of it all. But again, it was weird to win in front of an empty stadium. But at the same time, it was kind of cool because it was really just about the team.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for giving us so much of your time. And we're going to be rooting for you in Paris, knock on wood.
Yeah, knock on wood. Thank you, guys. It was a blast talking.
It's always intimidating to me when we speak to somebody who's excellent at not just one sport, but many sports.
I, just in listening to her talk about the sport of water polo and the process of how the teams are decided and cutting down on the roster as you get closer to the games, because of that the sport is in some ways like a little cutthroat, right? And you can kind of see how it breeds that level of competitiveness, especially when you're spending all that time together and people are making enormous sacrifices to be part of that process.
Yeah, it's brutal. It's a brutal sport, water polo, but that, I mean, there's a British soccer player, captain England, called Tony Adams, and the interview was talking about the stresses and the pressures of professional sport. And he said, if you do a bad interview with me, you'll be back tomorrow, won't you, to do an interview with somebody else. He goes, if I have a bad game, there's at least two more people waiting to take my place. That's pressure. That's pressure in sport. But when they're people you've trained with every day for up to 4 years, and then you don't necessarily get to go.
You guys can't cut me.
No, I think we are a three, aren't we? We're not going to be a duo or no one's going to, come on. I think I'd kind of like to see Kaylee surfing at the LA Games. I would like that very much, I think.
Well, that's it from me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. And join us next time for more of this.
Calling him out on being a cheat. And I've been getting all these messages on Instagram from angry Italians telling me how much of a bad person I am. But yeah, I still wouldn't change the fact, even if I get abuse from certain people. I think it's very important, not just for myself, but all the other athletes that did the right thing.
Jared Talent, next time on The Podium.
Hi, Yaya Toure here for a brand new podcast from the BBC World Service, Match of the Day, Africa Top 10. Join me and fellow footballers, Gabriel Zakwani.
Hello.
And Ifan Okuku.
Hi.
As we choose our top 10 from the best of Africa football.
We're not here to play football, but to argue about all things African football.
That's Match of the Day, Africa Top 10. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcast.